The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia Online. My name is Jason Freeman. I'm a producer and editor here in the Free Library's author events office, and I'm honored to be here to introduce tonight's author, Donald Antrim. Praised by the New York Times as a fiercely intelligent writer, Donald Antrim is the author of three critically acclaimed novels, Elect Mr. Robinson for a Better World, The Hundred Brothers, and The Verificationist. His other work includes Afterlife, a memoir about his mother, The Emerald Light in the Air, which I have right here and I'm a huge fan of, a story collection compiled from his published works, frequent appearances in The New Yorker, and essays and articles published in a variety of periodicals. He has received grants and awards from the Guggenheim Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and the MacArthur Foundation, among others. He joins us tonight with One Friday in April, a story of suicide and survival. In it, he uses the harrowing circumstances surrounding his 2006 suicidal thoughts and actions to reframe this misunderstood illness as something other than the choice of a depressed person. Named one of the most anticipated books of 2021 by the Los Angeles Times, Literary Hub, and the Millions, George Saunders beautifully referred to it thusly: "This book is an act of generosity. Antrim is trying to tell us something deeply true, not just about the suicidal, but about all of us, about our culture, about the way we live, about how we might lead better, more authentic, more connected lives." Tonight's author will be in conversation with Jonathan Franzen, bestselling author of, among other works of fiction and nonfiction, Freedom, Purity, and The Corrections. And just a week ago, he appeared on our stage, on our virtual stage, as it were, with his new novel, Crossroads. Donald, Jonathan, thank you both so much for being here. And the screen is all yours.
Thank you.
Hey, here we are, Donald.
Hey, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm good.
You know, it's just so great to be here tonight, and it's so great to be here celebrating a new book from you. It just seems like far too long since we've had that pleasure, and just delighted to welcome you back. And I've been struck in the last couple of weeks by how many people I'm hearing from who read the excerpt from this book in The New Yorker, just spontaneously telling me, my God, that was a powerful piece that meant so much to me. And I think that's partly about the story you're telling, but I think it's also partly about who's telling it, namely you. Donald is seriously one of the most distinctive voices in American literature, certainly in my lifetime. A unique stylist. No one writes like Donald, and it's just great to be reading your sentences again.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here with you, John.
So this is a book that begins on a Friday in April that I remember very well. I remember the weather, that kind of awful, sickly, late winter New York weather. The trees bare, the sidewalks are disgusting. And in my memory, it even has a kind of suicide flavor that time of year. It's the worst time of year in New York City, I think. And I remember riding out to Brooklyn from Manhattan. I think it was with Jeff and David when you had been admitted to the hospital in Brooklyn. Right. And, you know, we knew you hadn't been doing well. We knew you'd been spinning, but you're a dramatic guy. And I don't think any of us really had any concept of what a dangerous place you were in that day, that weekend, or in the months that followed. And like, even when you spent the summer up at Columbia Presbyterian, I still just didn't get what you were going through, what you'd been through up on your roof in Brooklyn. So for people in the audience who haven't read the book yet, I thought it might be good if you could tell us about, just sort of set the scene, or maybe even read from the beginning of the book so we know what that Friday in April refers to.
I'll read a little bit.
Great.
And then talk about it all some. This is the opening of the book. One Friday in April 2006, I spent the afternoon and evening pacing the roof of my apartment building in Brooklyn, climbing down the fire escape ladder and hanging by my hands from the railing, then climbing back up with sore palms and lying on the roof in a ball, or stretched out on my back or on my stomach, maybe peering surreptitiously over the roof's ledge. The roof is painted silver. The building is 4 stories tall. A group of my friends, each of whom had been on the phone with me, one after the other, all through the morning, when I'd been alone and dialing wildly, had got busy calling each other. Janice owned a car, and she and Nikki were coming across the bridge from Manhattan, but there was traffic, and no one knew where I was. From the roof, the world seemed to scream. I heard sirens, police, ambulance, and fire. What agency would come for me? A helicopter was flying overhead and circling back. The woman I'd just run from, the woman who had rushed over ahead of the others, who had been with me downstairs in my apartment, my partner then, Reagan, thought I'd gone to the street. We had been fighting over something I'd done. I'd hurt her, and we were both in anguish. She spoke harshly, and I ran away to die and end her burden. She charged after me, but the wrong way, down instead of up, out the front door of the building and toward the avenue. The sun was setting and the sky over New Jersey was orange, and I was in my socks shivering. I was afraid for my life. I didn't know why I had to fall from the roof, why that was mine to do. When telling the story of my illness, I try not to speak about depression. I prefer to call it suicide. The American novelist William Styron, in his memoir, Darkness Visible, A Memoir of Madness, argues that the word depression is inadequate to describe the illness, and I agree. A depression is a concavity, sloping downward in a return. Suicide, in my experience, is not that. I believe that suicide is a natural history, a disease process, not an act or a choice, a decision or a wish. I do not understand suicide as a response to pain or as a message to the living, or not only as those things. I do not think of suicide as the act, the death, the fall from a height, or the trigger pulled. I see it as a long illness, an illness with origins in trauma and isolation, in deprivation of touch, in violence and neglect, in the loss of home and belonging. It is a disease of the body and the brain, if you make that distinction. But its etiology, its beginning, whether in early or later life, in the family or beyond, is social in nature. I see suicide as a social disease. I will refer to suicide, not depression. My sickness lasted years. It continued after that Friday on the roof and went on for more than a decade through long hospitalizations and more than 50 rounds of electroconvulsive therapy, once known as shock therapy. It lasted through a decade of recovery, relapse, and recovery. Those times seem far removed, though they can also feel recent in memory. Up on the roof, I felt as if I had been dying all my life. I felt that it had begun when I was a little child.
And we hear about you as a little child in the book and some of the most striking passages in it. These are filling out a story we'd heard parts of in the afterlife.
Right.
So where did this book as a book come from? I mean, what was, when did you write the first pages of it? When did you begin to think, I'm going to write a book about suicide?
I wrote the first pages of this in more recent years. I began to think about doing it while I was in the hospital for the first time, while I was in my first long hospitalization.
Really, that early?
Oh, yeah. I thought that I would need to do it or find some excuse not to if I could live through the situation. There was a day in the hospital when I got up and walked across the common room, and I could feel the hairs on my arms tingling, almost as if there were a heavy breeze. And I'd felt physically sick. I'd felt sick all over for a long time. It was a long hospitalization. This was after the Brooklyn hospitalization when I was at the New York State Psychiatric Institute in Upper Manhattan. It's part of, attached to Columbia. And I think it was then that I really began to wonder how one would describe this illness. I hadn't really read descriptions of it. I'd read hyperbolic or metaphoric exclamations about it, but I hadn't really read a concrete description of it. So I began thinking about it then as a kind of a problem in writing. What kind of thing would I have to do? What sort of writing would it take? Would there be a special form for doing this? The afterlife, the book about my mother, I had begun a year after she died. And that was really too soon. That book was the catalyst for this, whatever you want to call it, breakdown. So this time I waited. I figured that I could survive memoir, but I had to wait. And I waited a very long time. And during that time, for most of those years, up until about 2016, during that time, I thought about this constantly. You know, I talked about it all the time. If you saw me in those later years before I began, and then as I was writing, I would collar you and talk about suicide.
Taking notes along the way, making sketches, drafts, anything, or just all in your head?
All in my head for a long time. I began taking notes and writing little drafts in about 2016. I used to write emails with my ideas to my editor at the New Yorker, Deborah Treisman, and she would write kindly, kind of write back to me. But there's a whole repository of ideas and paragraphs that she got in the mail. But writing in earnest really began after I met my wife. I think I felt safer with her. I felt more secure. I felt some sort of ballast. So writing in earnest really began around 2017 after we'd met.
Was there a sense of, I don't know, maybe not quite the right word, but of superstition? Your crisis had preceded the publication, but followed the writing of The Afterlife. Was it a sense of, like, I touched that stove, I don't want to touch that stove in any hurry again, or?
I thought I'd be okay. I thought I'd be okay doing this somehow. I think that maybe because I'd survived memoir, I thought that I would survive it again without too much trouble. It wasn't that so much. It was that I was alone, and I felt somewhat barren, you know. And I did feel vulnerable when I was alone. I didn't really want to write the book, but I couldn't stop thinking about it. And I knew it's what I would do. It just took a very long time to come to it.
It's striking that there you are, still absolutely sick enough to be in the hospital, not ready to leave, having weird sensations in your body, but functioning somehow as a writer, that like even then you were considering it in terms of how would I describe this?
Yeah. Yeah.
As if, however, foundational suicide had been in your life, the fact that you're a writer was equally foundational.
And it didn't stop there. I was hospitalized again, you know, four years later. So it suicide really did become foundational in my life.
Right.
And much more so than writing for a long time. I didn't write for years. You know, it was too, well, it was frightening to do, but I didn't feel like I really had my skills, whatever it is that we call writing. I didn't feel that I could do it, and I was afraid to see what I would do. So I read very little and I wrote very little for several years there after this event, after the hospitalization.
It was interesting to hear you read those first pages, because there's something about your voice, there's something about the words set on the page that from the experience of your novels certainly, but some of your nonfiction as well, leads you to expect this is going to be funny. I wonder if Was that part of it, that you were not in a position to be funny? I feel like, I think just as writing is in your bones, I feel that certainly from in fiction, I struggle to imagine you not being funny in fiction. Was that part of what was out of reach in those years?
Well, fiction in general seemed completely out of reach. I wrote a few stories and they took forever to do. I think one of the things that made it seem out of reach was the fact that I was going to write about suicide at all.
Right.
I didn't feel qualified, even though I'd had these experiences. You know, what qualified me to do this? Finally, I did a lot of reading and, you know, sort of informal research. But at a certain point along the way, thinking about it, I had the sense that I would write about suicide as a and have I had a kind of an alternative version of it or an alternative view of it, which begins with the idea that the suicide wants to live and not die. And if we follow that thinking, then we can make a case for a long illness as opposed to a bad outcome of a long illness.
Right, and the possibility of self-intervention and intervention and improvement.
Right, exactly. And treatment.
And treatment, yeah. Mm-hmm. When you say not qualified, does that refer to your not having medical training? Does that refer to your having merely had ideation, thoughts, a wish to not be there, or a sense that you were not going to be there? Rather than, I don't know, the scars on your wrist or something to validate your authority as a spokesman on suicide?
Well, I had no wish to not be there. I had a wish to live. I had a wish to survive.
I was trying to correct myself mid-sentence.
Yeah. But I had a sense that I might not be for a long time.
Yeah.
It was... It's hard to say. I think that I felt not qualified because I felt, yeah, certainly because I didn't have degrees in medicine or whatnot. But it was just, I think, a fear of speaking, a fear of standing up and saying something that was new or that was felt different to me about the whole problem. I think that I felt vulnerable doing that.
Vulnerable to what? I mean, did you have a concrete imagination of what might follow that was unpleasant if you did speak up?
Just rejection.
Yeah.
You know, I was afraid of rejection. More so than, say, writing a novel or writing stories. You know, because of the ideas.
Yeah, well, that was part of why I've been struck by the response to the New Yorker excerpt, was that this is not a subject that people automatically feel like reading at bedtime about.
Right.
Yeah, you're it's a tough one, and yet I have the sense that you found a way to do it that is getting around that resistance on readers' part.
Well, it's largely memoir, which probably helps.
Yeah.
So there's a story there. And then there's some philosophizing, I guess you would call it, about suicide.
Related to the philosophizing, I think I kind of know what you're getting at in the distinction between depression and suicide. But when I think about depression, it could also be described as a social disease.
Sure.
And it also often has roots in trauma and isolation. So you make that very, I mean, it's very strategically planted. You start with the immediate present narrative, and then very quickly you hit hard with that paragraph. And instead of building to a, you know, your closing argument before the jury, you build to these cascading questions late in the book, and I want to get back to that. But first, I'm curious if you could maybe unpack for us a little bit more what you mean by that distinction between depression and suicide.
Well, it starts off as just a wish for a stronger terminology. Styron has the same wish, feels that it's not a strong enough word to describe what's going on. Styron suggests brainstorm, but I don't.
Yeah,
I don't really think that's the appropriate term. Calling it suicide for me is a way of attaching suicide to the disease rather than separating it from the disease. In other words, I mean depression when I say suicide. I guess I mean, what I really mean is psychotic depression, depression that's got out of hand.
Right.
As opposed to a little bit of the blues, you know.
Although I think the blues comes up in that very long paragraph of other things that suicide has been called.
Right.
getting back, go ahead.
To call it suicide is maybe not, I don't think I'm necessarily recommending that we all switch now and call it suicide. It was for the purposes of this book to make this point that suicide is more than just an unfortunate consequence of depression, that it's depression is leading towards suicide, that it is that the feeling of death in body and brain is going on before that.
Surely at a syntactical level, suicide means killing yourself.
Right.
And to say suicide is an illness, I mean, that there's a paradox even in using that noun in that way.
It right.
suggests that it is not a moment, it's not an act, it is a complex of things.
We feel as if we're dying by our own hand during intense depression. You know, that I did anyway. I mean, I can only tell my story, but I felt implicated in my own dying, which was sure to come. Every mistake I'd made, every error I'd made in my life, and then a kind of amplified version of mistake and error, in which everything I'd done had been a mistake and an error. So I saw myself as implicated in my own dying before I ran up to the roof. If that makes any sense.
It does. And I think one of the great things you've done in the book is you keep circling and circling, and it's like the language itself is in that circling without ever quite hitting the center, nonetheless giving us a 3D picture of what's at the center of what it's circling. But the opening, you know, the narrator is up on the roof, hanging from the fire escape, it's not funny, but you know, the worried friends are there, and this guy is isolated up, you know, kind of up in the air. And then the way it veers away from that moment and comes back, it's rather reminiscent of your books. I'm thinking particularly right. of Tom and the verificationist, who literally floats to the ceiling after a too vigorous bear hug from his friends at the Pancake House. But also, I'm also thinking of Doug in The 100 Brothers, which is one of my favorite American novels of the last, well, really of my lifetime. And Doug is the brother who's most central to the family, but also really almost because of his centrality, the most alienated. I wonder how you look at those novels now, which were written before April 2006, and before
right.
your long struggle with suicide. How does your fiction stand in relation to the nonfiction?
Well, Tom in The Verificationist actually winds up in the hospital at the very end of the book. He winds right. up on the psych ward. Hospital that floats in like he's been floating above everyone else. So it felt a little bit of a prediction to me, you know.
And maybe you were already describing a state that you came to know better.
Well, they're all isolated men.
Yeah.
And they're all making mistakes left and right. So I have a lot in common with those characters. Looking back at those books, I like them pretty much. I think they're okay. And I'd like to get back to writing funny fiction, which is my plan for after this, is to return some to that line or to that thread, if I can. And obviously it'll be changed by this experience, but I think I'll be capable of doing something along those lines, something closer to those novels. We'll see.
Well, I mean, you can write whatever you want, but wouldn't mind seeing some more fiction from you. It's just for the audience, Donald is one of the funniest people I've ever met.
Not tonight.
And of course, well, not tonight. We'll work on that. Let's get it going. Also, probably by, you wouldn't mind my saying this, one of the more mentally ill people I know, and funny and mentally ill.
I don't mind your saying that at all. I'm a proud member of America's Mentally Ill.
Yeah, and I mean, a word I haven't used, but is suggested by the reluctance you felt to get into writing this book. It is a very brave thing you've done, and that comes through. I think that has to do with why people are responding in the way they are. It's like someone actually took the risk of trying to go right at it, which is amazing. I want to come back to what you describe as the catalyst for that.
Right.
That crisis in 2007, which was the impending publication of The Afterlife. And again, something to unpack here maybe a little bit. If suicide had always been part of you, or certainly had deep roots dating from what your really certifiably fucked up childhood, right. Then you seem to be suggesting that suicide is resistant to narratives. We can apply these stories, we can tell ourselves stories of why someone arrives at, in a profoundly suicidal state, but those actually aren't doing justice to the non-narrative essence of it.
Right.
So what do you think now about the connection of the timing between that being when you really had the big crisis that has changed your life and the fact that you had written, but you were still facing publication of The Afterlife? I mean, is there a story there?
It's
tempting. It's just because of the timing. It's tempting to make a narrative out of that.
Yeah. At the time when I began The Afterlife, my mother was still a mortifying character to me. She'd lived her life, most of her life, as a serious alcoholic. She got sober, but it remained somewhat crazy and very difficult for her children. I had no plans to write about her. I had no intention of writing about her, no desire to write about her. But after she died, within a year, I was writing about her. And writing that book, well, it was published in the New Yorker as it went along, chapter at a time. And writing those sections was exhilarating, but also highly anxiety provoking. I was in terrible anxiety. When I was at the desk and working, I was in good shape. When I got up from the desk and was walking around the house, I was in bad shape. And particularly after publishing the pieces of it, I would go and want to just hide under the bed for 2 or 3 weeks. So it was an exhilaration to do, but it was too soon to do. And I felt that I was betraying her and myself. You know, I guess I just brought it all up, you know, that was for the first time that I had done that and been in therapy for years. But to do it in writing, to do it as part of, to do it as a book was a real, well, you know what I'm talking about. It's a, it really changes the terms.
Sure.
You know? So when I finished it after about 5 years, I felt quite exhilarated, but within just a couple of weeks after having turned it in, I felt myself degrading. I felt myself going into more and more intense anxiety. And that anxiety just continued on and on and on. And by the middle of the winter, I was checking my pulse constantly. I wasn't sleeping. I was smoking cigarettes. At the time, I knew that it was because I'd written this book, and I couldn't bear anything, the publication that was coming. I just got blindsided by it, really. So it was the catalyst for the breakdown.
And right.
That took just about a year to really come into focus. And it was just 3/4 of a year between handing that book in, that manuscript, and then being on the roof.
The word brainstorm, maybe not so terrible after all, if you can get rid of its other more common meaning.
Right.
Sense the clouds building, the lightning inside that cloud, as more and more energy goes into it. I wonder if just from, you had after all published pieces of that book in,
right,
in a magazine with a circulation of 1 million. I wonder if it had more to do with the fact that you no longer had the refuge of writing the pages. That it sounds like you were able to get through the writing of that book because as long as you were sitting at your desk, you were kind of saying what you needed to say, and then the rest of your life was a mess. But you did have that time in those pages. And that's what makes the book publication so awful, is the writing is all done. There's nothing more to do.
Right. So in the sense that I was postponing mourning.
Yeah.
In some way. Well, that may have been true because this was a classic complicated bereavement. I didn't ever really know how to mourn my mother. I still haven't figured it out.
You know, something similar happened to me, I have to say. I was, I wrote the corrections, most of the corrections after my mother died. My father had been dead for some years, and I remember so well the day before I finished the book. I could see I've got one more day of writing to do, and I was just overwhelmed with grief. And it came to me that as long as I was not done with the book, my parents were still alive. And it was the somehow I'd been keeping something at bay as long as I had it to work on.
Have you had anything like that happen since for other characters?
No. I also haven't written a book with characters who have so much in common with real life as
right.
The parents and the corrections do. there are many ways to take the book. And you can reread it in a not that long evening, and it bears rereading and re-rereading. But to me, the strongest and most moving message is very simple. It's that doctors can help. And that comes through very powerfully. I mean, that was the takeaway on the first read for me, which is, here's a person who's speaking with authority. Don't be afraid of the hospital. The hospital's a good place. Which is, as I say, it's a very powerful and moving, the way you deliver it, message. I wonder if you can talk about your relationship with therapy in the medical world before that crisis in 2006. I mean, did you experience any internal resistance? I'm reading my question that I wrote down on your way to becoming a public advocate for the hospital.
Did I feel resistance to the hospital?
No, I mean, I'm trying to Because you had been in therapy.
Yeah, for years, just for years and years.
For years and years. And something changed.
None of my therapy up to that point was psychiatric.
Right.
It was psychotherapeutic. I didn't ever have therapy with a psychiatrist. So when I went to the hospital, I was surrounded by psychiatrists, who are a somewhat different breed. They're especially inpatient psychiatrists. They're there every day taking care of people who've come in like sick like me, you know? So it was a different kind of, it was a very different experience. When I went to the hospital, when I took myself to the hospital for the first long stay in May of 2006, I first felt, I was terrified, and I was terrified to be there, to see myself there, to imagine myself there. What did it mean? How long would it be? Coming down the stairs from the roof that day in April, I had the sense that I would go to the hospital. In fact, I did briefly in Brooklyn before talking my way out. But I remember thinking that it would take years and years to get through this, that if I were going to get through this, it wouldn't happen overnight. When I finally got to the hospital for the long stay, I felt a sense of relief mixed with fear, because I was safer. I couldn't so easily die in the hospital. So I had this, you know, we're protected there.
Although you thought you were dying, I remember.
I thought I was dying. Yeah. I thought I would die, and I thought I was dying. But at first, when I was there, I felt a sense of relief that I could try to put that away a little bit. And I was never able to, really. But it was better to be there, I realized, than it was to try to be out in the world. I couldn't function out in the world. I was very sick. I mean, I couldn't walk a straight line, particularly. You know, I never slept. Smoking constantly. I was agitated. I was pacing up and down the halls. I would sit on that tarp that I dragged out from under the bed. For a long time, I took a tarp that I had under the bed, and I would drag it up to the living room and stretch it out on the floor and sit there with a knife in one hand and a bottle of pills in the other hand, thinking that this might be the day. This might be the day. And then I would write suicide notes to Reagan. But I never got very far with them. They were all crimped up notes with very little punctuation. I wasn't clear on anything I was doing. I couldn't really write very clearly. I think when I finally got to the hospital, I felt relief, but I also felt real alienation. I wanted my doctors to make me better, and they couldn't do it right away. I had a long drug trial. Went on for 2 months with a drug called nortriptyline. I didn't trust them in my deepest sickness. You know, I was paranoid about them. I thought that they had me in the wrong hospital. I had what felt like vascular issues and rheumatological issues.
Yep.
You know, I had all that going on. Finally, though, when they came and suggested that I do ECT, a number of circumstances led me to do it, including the phone call from David Foster Wallace, which you knew about. And as I got better in ECT, which took a little while, I began not only to trust my doctors, but to admire them. And I still feel that. I feel great admiration and great trust and great consolation that they're there. The hospital can be a very difficult place to be. I was in a very good hospital at that point. And so I was fortunate in that regard too. There were good people around. There were other patients to talk to. It wasn't the worst hospital experience, I don't think, though I was devastated through most of it.
There's available a faint reading or reading of something faintly visible, but there, I think, in the book of you're finding a home. I mean, you are through the dislocations of your childhood that always, and always looking to be alone in a room, that first of all, you were put in a place where you really were not allowed to be alone all the time.
Right.
And that in a sense became part of what you were looking for, which is a sense of recognition and a place where it was okay to be what you were.
In the hospital, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's probably the case.
Yeah.
Probably the case.
I'm going to fulfill my moderator duties here by clicking on the Q&A button, which I've never done before, so this is a little scary. Okay. Ready to go, Donald?
Sure.
Mr. Antrim, this comes from Olivia DiLeonardo. Mr. Antrim, I just finished this gorgeous book. Thank you so much for writing it. The part of it that resonates most with me is the writing about the hospital. Your description almost makes it sound like an oasis or a lifeline. On page 131, you write, "What is the hospital, if not all of us?" I work in a children's hospital, and I often have this feeling about it, that it embodies such humanity and hope as well as despair. Could you possibly elaborate further on your feelings about the hospital and how you feel about it now as opposed to when you were there? We sort of covered that, but maybe you have a few additional thoughts for Olivia DiLeonardo.
Well, I feel extremely grateful for the hospital. And I feel like my experience there brought me from a point of isolation or a place of isolation, brought me further into the world in some ways. Especially after the first time that I was in the hospital, when I got better on ECT, and it was such a glorious experience to get better. I remember walking down the hall with the head nurse a little bit before I realized that I was actually improving. But I could hold my head up a little bit better, and I could walk a straighter line. And I asked her if she thought that I was improving, if she thought that I was getting any better. And she said, "Yes, yes, absolutely, you are. We can all see it. We all see it before you do." And that stuck with me as evidence of a community dedicated to health or dedicated to well-being, which I very much felt that I was part of there.
We have a question from Kelly Powers, who asks, "Was there a part of the treatment that addressed the rebuilding of your capacity in reading and writing, specific exercises, or just a wait for the resumption of normalcy?"
For me, it was a wait. I waited for the resumption of normalcy, if you could put it that way. At the time, I thought I was taking a break. I did a lot of shopping for books that I thought I might need or want one day, many of which went into my reading for this book, as if I were preparing to write this. But I didn't do any clinical exercises or special therapy to get that back. I stayed in therapy, but I just didn't write. And finally, I did again. Slowly, I took it up. I did with a few short stories, but it was touch and go for a long time. Now I'm writing.
We have a question related to that from Bertha Sarmina. Did the process of writing trigger any fear of relapsing?
I think at times when I first began writing this, when I was all alone, when I was writing notes or when I was writing emails to Deborah Treisman, I think I had that thought. And I had the thought more than I had the fear. In other words, I wasn't going to stop doing what I was doing. I didn't think that it would put me back in the hospital. But I had the thought.
You know? Yeah.
I didn't feel that it would. But it was definitely, for some of those years, I think it was an issue because I was alone, and felt isolation. So it was very difficult to work under those circumstances. For me, it was anyway. So I did sketches. I did little approaches to things. I tried to write short manuscripts describing what I wanted to say. And I was able to do that. But I never felt, until I finally did, for all those years, I didn't feel prepared to write. I felt that I had to get through some other kind of mourning or some other kind of grief or some other kind of, towards some other kind of clarity. When I was in the hospital having ECT the first time, I would be in tears and just weeping, have the nurse hold my hand. And I would look up at the ceiling and I couldn't really see the doctors, but I knew that they were around me. And I would say, let's have a good seizure. And then I'd say, I want to be consolidated. So what I was waiting for was that feeling that I was consolidated, that I was back in some way. And that just took a long time to happen. I functioned in other areas of my life very well. So maybe it was a little bit of superstition that writing had got me into that trouble. Why would I want to do it again? But when I finally got around to writing this, I think I was over that.
Tab Anzinger or Anzinger asks, did you read other books on brainstorms in addition to the Styron? And would you recommend any of them to people enduring a similar mental situation? Also wondering if A. Alvarez's The Savage God made your list and your thought on it. Thank you.
I didn't read as much as I thought I would on depression or suicide. And the reason was that every time I began reading anyone, I would find this sort of belief about suicide that it came as an act of will or as a desire or as a wish. And I knew that I wanted to say something different. So I didn't read that much after a while. I just wanted to do my own thing, as it were. I read parts of Suicide by K. Redfield Jameson, and I read, I have an aphasia, I'm not really sure, Madness by Roy Porter. So I did do some reading, but I didn't make a library list.
Bart Dayton asks, when you and your team thought you were ready to leave, did you fully trust your and their judgment, or did you think it might be a bit of a crapshoot? Thank you both for this important conversation.
This book takes up two major hospitalizations, and the first time I left, I felt ready to go. I felt in one piece, I felt intact. I felt very consolidated. I wasn't ready to read or write so much, but I did feel consolidated in some way. So I was happy to go, and I was joyful, really. I used to sit on benches out in the park and just look at the trees and feel a kind of joy. The second time I came out of the hospital, the second time from this book, I wasn't ready to go. I'd had a lot of ECT and it hadn't really hit the spot, but it had helped me enough so that I could go. But I was still an anxious wreck when I left. It had just been so much. I'd had 36, 37 rounds of ECT and I wasn't getting much better. So I just took a chance and left. Eventually that ironed out and I was able to function better. But so I had both experiences. You know, I had a readiness to go and a feeling of confidence and a feeling of joy in going. And then the next time around I had real fear in going and just a sense of frustration.
A practical and not entirely unrelated question would be from Carrie Arsenault. Hi, Carrie. Kind of a technical question, but my concerns lie in related social issues. I'm wondering if you had health insurance at the time, and if yes, I worry and wonder what happens to those who don't.
I did not have health insurance the first time through, and I did the second time through. The New York State Psychiatric Institute didn't charge because it's a research hospital. And I was there as a clinical patient in order to get better. I was funneled there by my friend Anne, who was a doctor at Columbia, a psychiatrist who was working in the psych emergency room where I took myself. It was her doing, really, that I got there to begin with. The second time I went through, I did have health insurance. I was teaching at that time, and I had a good health insurance. I made it through without terrible debt. I do know we need to find a lot of improvement in our health insurance system, but I was very fortunate.
Yeah, it stigma is one word, but I think discomfort is another word around mental health and related issues. I think it makes it it's a tougher sell than it should be. I think to get comprehensive care for people who need mental health care, and you see it, you see it with a lot of people who don't have a roof over their head. They're clearly struggling with stuff, and it just seems like from every perspective, including economically, it would make so much sense to really dedicate ourselves to a strong mental health care system. My two cents. We have a question from Tina Hallquist, or Quist. Thank you for your book. Did losing friend S to suicide in any way alter your perspective on this illness?
Did losing friends?
Or a friend or friends.
Friend or friends.
I mean, this seems to presume that you did, or have. So maybe the question would be, have you lost a friend to suicide? And if you have, did it alter?
The only friend I've lost to suicide was a friend who came and helped me choose to go to ECT, and that was David Foster Wallace.
Yeah.
And we didn't even know each other that well. I never lost people in my childhood to suicide. I was never near it. And there's no one in my family who died of suicide. I know that I've talked to people who seem to have been surrounded by people who've taken their own lives, but I wasn't. So with the exception of David, but I wasn't shaped or formed by suicide in my childhood, by the suicides of others.
There is a tangentially related question. This is a follow-up from Olivia. P.S. Sorry, I just want to add this additional comment. I love how the book does not allow us to other, that would be a verb, suicide, with its pointed questions such as, have you ever tried to die? It made me feel as if we are all susceptible. Was this your intent with these questions? I found them to be extremely powerful. And that was actually going to be one of my questions. I wanted to come back to that cascade of questions you ask in the late pages. What an incredible formal choice that was.
I wanted to address someone who might be suffering, who would have that book. You know, I wanted to make a direct address that would be inclusive. I mean, if we see suicide as a kind of an illness instead of as a consequence of an illness, and if we understand that this suicide is trying to live, after all, we live for a long time with these symptoms sometimes, then that to me could be destigmatizing, or it could help with the problem of stigma.
There was something about the way, I mean, it's really noticeable. I mean, it's just a, you know, question marks all down the page toward the end. And it is remarkable how that, it does open something up. It was to me so much more effective than your, now we've considered the evidence and we'll return to my original proposition and I will do this. It was so, there was a humility to it and a generosity to the framing of it as that series of questions that I thought really worked. We have one more question, and it's an unexpected one. This is again from Bart Dayton. An additional question, if you don't mind.
Right.
Were most of the people in the mental hospitals white?
At Columbia, yes. At the Institute, yes. They were, in fact, and it's a good question to ask. Not all were. There were Hispanic patients, but mostly they were white. That's right.
And in the other hospital?
Well, I was at the Institute and then I was at Columbia.
Okay.
So at both of those hospitals.
And how did that happen? Well, how did it select that way, do you suppose?
Well, they're fine hospitals, university hospitals that were most likely sought out by people who knew that they were there, you know. I'm not really sure how that sorts out, you know.
Yeah. Donald, you've been very generous to talk to us. What time is it? It's 8:30 in the East. I'm speaking to you from Santa Cruz. It's great to see you again. It's an amazing book. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And thank you to everyone who came tonight. And thank you especially to those who asked some questions. Nobody's more relieved than the moderator and the author when people ask questions. So thank you for that. Donald, anything you'd like to, any final comment before we say goodnight?
No, just thank you. Thank you for being here and for doing this. I really appreciate it. It's a good way to go here to do this way with you.
Yeah, it's been good.
Yeah.
Well, good night, everybody, then.
Good night.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/author-events.